You're listening to Business Weekly on Intelligence Squared. This week, we're featuring an episode of the How I Found My Voice podcast in which Sir Richard Branson speaks to Samir Ahmed about becoming a serial entrepreneur, signing some of the biggest names in music and the next frontier of space travel. It's a fascinating conversation, and if you do enjoy it, you can subscribe to the How I Found My Voice podcast by searching for it in your podcast app. But now let's go to the episode.
So I went to the back of the airport, hoped my credit card wouldn't bounce, but I hired a plane. And as a joke, I wrote Virgin Airlines one way to the British Virgin Islands, $39, and filled up my first plane. We built a UFO, as you do, and we flew over London at 4:30 a.m. on April Fool's Day. I think I've made my view fairly clear about Brexit. I think it's the worst thing that's happened to Great Britain since the Second World War. I think it's the worst thing that's happened to Europe since the Second World War.
Hello and welcome to How I Found My Voice, a podcast from Intelligence Squared. I'm Samira Ahmed and I'm going behind the celebrity persona to find out what influences shaped their success. How did politicians, artists, writers and business leaders grow up to become such great and unique communicators? If you enjoy this episode, do rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Now, Sir Richard Branson was the original teen entrepreneur, a proper countercultural role model for academic dropouts everywhere. He created a business empire based on records, the glamour of air travel and space rockets. He started a magazine called Student at 16. His record label, Virgin Music, famously released Mike Oldfield's mass-selling instrumental album, Tubular Bells, and the Virgin Megastore was at the heart of the record-selling business for generations of young people. His successful ventures include an airline, Virgin Atlantic, banking Virgin Money and the privatised railways Virgin West Coast and Virgin Healthcare running contracts for the NHS. Now, according to the Sunday Times Rich List, he's the 34th richest person in the UK worth £4.05 billion. Richard, where are you speaking to us from?
The beautiful island of Necker Island in the British Virgin Islands.
And as we're speaking, I think we've got a month's rainfall falling in one day over the UK. What's the weather like where you are?
The nice thing about the Caribbean is it's 12 months of pretty well beautiful weather every day, every 10 years, a dreadful hurricane. And I think we had the worst in history hit us about 18 months ago, which we've nearly recovered from.
Well, I'm about to take you back to your childhood, but I also wanted to say to our listeners, as Richard is speaking to us from his island, there is sometimes interference with the line, so apologies if the sound quality is not up to our usual standard. So, Richard, what sort of home were you growing up in, and what was your childhood like?
A very lucky childhood, two delightful younger sisters, a mum and dad that loved each other. We lived in a little village in Surrey, and I would spend most of my time out playing with friends in the countryside and getting up to mischief. My father had just come back from the war. He became a barrister and somewhat struggling barrister. And he would bring his briefs back and, you know, I'd look at the front of the briefs and he'd be getting, you know, three guineas or five guineas a brief, which wasn't a lot of money, but it managed to, keep us all going just fine.
Tell me about your mother, because she sounds like she had quite a glamorous, racy life. She'd been a dancer, an actress, and a probation officer, and also flown planes. Is that right?
Gliders, yeah. My mum was the sort of the budding entrepreneur in the family. She would always be, trying new things, and she'd throw herself into everything and anything. And she still does, well into her 90s. We all ran to keep up with her. She wasn't allowed to get a gliding pilot's license and go into the Wren, so she dressed up as a boy in boy's clothes and cut her hair and managed to get in. So she's had a fun time.
We should say this was the Women's Royal Navy Service, the Wrens, during World War II.
Exactly, Women's Royal Navy Service at the time, yeah.
You're known as being quite adventurous. Do you think it's your mother that you get that from?
I suspect my adventure side comes from my mum from a very young age. You know, if I was once traveling to my grandmother's house, and I think I was having an argument with my sisters at the back of the car, and she just stopped the car, pushed me out, and told me to make my own way there. You know, it was about five miles from my grandmother's through the countryside. So she was a great believer in getting us to stand on our own two feet. And, you know, she'd put us on a bicycle and tell us to ride 200 miles in pouring rain to get somewhere. And, you know, her attitude was, you know, yes, there's risks attached to that, but hopefully the end result would be your kids will, if they survive, will be that much more capable.
Your grandparents put up the money to send you to boarding school. And it is one of those things that baffles non-Brits, the sending away of very little children to boarding school. What was that experience like? I know you ended up at Stowe, but presumably that wasn't at eight. Was that later?
That was later. I think it's a dreadful tradition. I mean, it's sort of a leftover from the times when Britain, you know, ruled the world, and our great-great-grandfathers were in India and they had to leave their families behind. I certainly didn't enjoy boarding school. For a while, I was quite good at sport, and I think, you know, sport helped me in boarding school. But I was also dyslexic, and if you're dyslexic, in those days, they hadn't heard of the word dyslexia, and they just thought I was thick, you know, so I would really struggle to get along at school. And, you know, the positive thing about that was I decided to start getting interested in things that were not conventional schoolwork, like, you know, the Vietnamese War and the Biafran War and, you know, the provos in Holland and the, you know, students marching on the streets for different causes. And so, you know, aged 14, 15, I decided to start a magazine for young people to address some of these issues. And because I was dyslexic, tried to surround myself with people who were better than me, who could compensate for my weaknesses.
So this magazine, did you actually start it up while you were still at school, or was it after you dropped out at 16?
So it was almost ready to go while I was at school. I worked out of the school phone box. In those days, obviously, there weren't mobile phones. I had to put money in the phone box when I was trying to sell advertising to Coca-Cola or Pepsi or whatever to help pay for the magazine. Often there were queues of students outside the phone box banging on the window. So it wasn't the most conducive place to sell advertising. But anyway, somehow we did manage to get enough advertising sold, about £4,000 worth of advertising. And coincidentally, around about that time, the headmaster called me into his office and said, "Richard, you're either going to have to stay at school and get on with your homework and forget this magazine lark, or you'll have to leave school to run the magazine." And that was the best excuse I could have. I said, "Thank you, but I'm going to leave school and start the magazine." And, you know, that weekend, went home to my parents and walked around the lawn with my dad about six times. And, you know, the first time round, he tried to persuade me out of it. By the sixth time around, he turned to me and said, "Look, you know what you want to do in life. I didn't know what I wanted to do when I was in my 20s. So give it a go. And if it doesn't work out, we'll do our best to get you an education." So it was a brave decision by my parents, and it worked out okay.
Absolutely. Well, I just want to ask one more thing about school. Am I right in thinking then when you did decide to leave, your headmaster told you that you would either end up in prison or as a millionaire, and he was right on both counts?
Yes, exactly right. Yeah, I think he realised I was quite extreme in whatever I did, and maybe slightly naughty. And I did spend a night in jail, and obviously Virgin went on to do great things.
Do you mind reminding us about, because it was just one night in jail, wasn't it?
Yes. So what happened was the magazine was going, and then we started offering young people music at a much better price than they were offered from other retailers. We called it Virgin Records. And then one day I got an order for some music from Belgium and got in a van, drove the records across to France. And they asked if we had a carnet, and we didn't know what a carnet was. But basically it was a piece of paper to prove that we'd exported them. We didn't have one, so they sent us back to the UK. By the way, this is the sort of problems you're going to have when we're no longer part of Europe, where you have to, you know, you have to pay taxes every time you go across a border. You have to fill in long forms. Anyway, so we came back to London and I thought, hang on a minute, everybody will think we've exported these. We can sell them in our store and not pay the tax. Anyway, it was a foolish thing to do. It taught me in life that it's not worth taking on authority in that kind of way. In order to pay the fine, we had to expand our Virgin Record shops as fast as we could and get the turnover going. You know, that gave us stimulation to build Virgin.
Fascinating. I think it's hard for people to grasp how much money your company was turning around how early on. So within a year of launching Student Magazine, I gather your net worth was £50,000. You've now got the mail order record business going, Virgin Records. What year is this? I mean, what kind of money are you turning over by this point?
We may have been turning over quite a lot of money. We certainly weren't making a lot of money. So, you know, in order to get the mail order company going, I would stand outside the Albert Hall or the Queen Elizabeth Hall, handing out leaflets to people as they left, listing all the records that we could sell them. You know, because we didn't have any cash, they would then send us the money. Then we would go and buy them from our record shops and at a discount, and then we would send the music to them. For some time, the record companies wouldn't supply us direct. And it was only when, you know, we did have a lot of people ordering a lot of records that the record industry finally dealt with us directly. Big turnover, very little profit in those days. It really wasn't until a young guy, age 15, brought a tape in that our sort of fortunes began to change. And by then I was, I can't remember, 18, 19 years old, maybe. You know, we loved this tape, but we didn't have a record company. So we took the tape to 8 other record companies. They all rejected it. And so we thought, we'll start our own record company. And we started it literally around this album called Tubular Bells. And it was by Mike Oldfield. You know, John Peel loved it as well. I took him, brought him to my houseboat, played in the whole record. He then played the whole record on the BBC, which was unheard of, 48 minutes of music. There was no vocals on it, but it exploded. And for 3 or 4 years, it and Dark Side of the Moon by Pink Floyd were either number one or number two, usurping each other.
Part of what's fascinating is we now look back from where we are in the music business with, you know, almost entirely digital at this remarkable couple of decades, and Virgin Records and you are there at the beginning and you're riding that wave when people were buying physical records, they were buying them in record shops. I just wonder what made you go into the music business?
It was literally just a love of that particular album that got us into it. I have a cousin in South Africa called Simon Draper who knocked on my door one day, and he became head of the record company. He had the biggest record collection of anybody I knew. Together, but using his musical taste, we ended up signing Genesis and Phil Collins and Lenny Kravitz and, you know, the Sex Pistols and the Rolling Stones and, anyway, a whole raft of bands, and became, you know, the biggest independent record company in the world. And it was tremendously exciting. People like Phil Collins or Peter Gabriel or Genesis could see what we'd done with the Sex Pistols. They wanted to sign with us, and many, many other people signed over the years.
With all this going on in your record label, as you say, the most successful independent record label in the world at the time, you were a millionaire by the time you were 23. The rock and roll industry has a reputation of being pretty wild. Were they wild times for you?
They were, except that because I knew that I had to get up at whatever it was, 7 every morning, and had a lot of people working for us, I curtailed the excesses that I think everybody else around me were doing. And I suspect that's quite lucky because I'm quite an addictive personality. So everybody was having a blast. It was a lot of fun.
I'm interested in how you came to set your sights on air travel and wanting to set up an airline.
I was in my late 20s, courting a lovely lady who's now my wife, and I'd been away from the Virgin Islands for about 3 weeks. And on the way back to the Virgin Islands, I was on an American Airlines plane in Puerto Rico when the captain announced that he'd been told that he couldn't fly to the Virgin Islands tonight, but he would fly in the morning when he could get a full load of passengers. And I was damned if I wasn't going to get home that night. It was the last flight out. So I went to the back of the airport. I hoped my credit card wouldn't bounce, but I hired a plane and borrowed a blackboard. And as a joke, I wrote Virgin Airlines one way to the British Virgin Islands, $39, and went around all the passengers who'd been bumped and filled up my first plane. And then the next day, I rang up Boeing and said, my name's Richard Branson. I have a company called Virgin Records. We have the Rolling Stones. Could I possibly buy a secondhand 747 from you? There was a bit of a laughter at the other end of the phone, but in the end, he said, look, I'll come and see you. We'll certainly talk about it, but only if you promise that you won't call the airline Virgin. He said, if you call it Virgin, nobody will expect to go the whole way. So anyway, he turned up. We managed to get our first secondhand 747, and we disobeyed him. As people know, we called the airline Virgin.
Where did the whole thing about your brand being called Virgin come from in the first place?
I was with a group of young 15, 16-year-old girls, and one of them laughed and said, you're Virgin at Business, we're all virgins, why don't you call it Virgin? And I was certainly Virgin at Business, so it seemed like a fun thing to do. And then I had real problems trying to get it registered. The registry office thought it was rude, and for 3 or 4 years we couldn't actually register it, although we just carried on. In the end, I wrote them a letter, having looked at the dictionary, and said, look, Virgin means pure, untouched, unblemished. Perhaps you could reconsider. And they reconsidered.
Well, it's interesting the way that that word has that risque association, even as you say, you successfully argued on some of the dictionary definitions. And the first commercial flight that Virgin Airways had, it's been documented by, I think, a former travel editor of one of the Fleet Street papers about this wild party. And he says, let me tell you, it was a bacchanalian orgy. I mean, it was wild. There was drinking. There were topless models on the plane. It was having a party, and Richard led from the front. Do you remember that first flight?
I remember it well. I can't remember topless models, but anyway, I can remember everything else. You know, what we wanted to do was to differentiate ourselves from the stuffy British Airways. I mean, the only reason I decided to start an airline was because our rivals, British Airways and Pan Am and TWA, you know, they would dump a lump of chicken on your lap, no seatback videos, no films. The staff were fairly obviously didn't enjoy their jobs in those days. So we thought we could do it differently, and we thought we could make it a fun airline. Everything about Virgin was different, and it had to be different because, you know, if you look at the history of the airline industry, it's littered with failures. I mean, like, we were competing with 20 airlines with one plane. Most of those other airlines had 300 planes. Pretty well every single one, bar one, have gone bust. So Pan Am, TWA, Air Florida, People Express, British Caledonian disappeared. You know, they just hadn't got the product right so that the public really wanted to travel on them. And it was quite easy for the likes of British Airways to push them over the cliff. When British Airways tried to push us over the cliff and launch the Dirty Tricks campaign against us, the public stuck with us. We took British Airways to court. Things worked out okay, but it did result in me having to sell the record company to make sure that we could combat them. And that was a sad day, but we then had the financial strength to make sure the record company was secure, the airline was secure, and we had the resources to take Virgin forward into new foundations, etc.
It's quite a roller coaster that time, and I remember it. For those who don't, remind us, what were the dirty tricks that BA launched against you?
You know, when I tell you, it almost sounds too unbelievable to be true, but they had a team behind locked doors, which nobody was allowed to enter, and they were going into our computer information, and they were then getting the names of our passengers. This team of people ringing our passengers, pretending to be from Virgin, saying that Virgin had a delayed flight, and then switched them on to British Airways. You know, that was one thing they were doing. They had a team of people at the airports who were trying to intercept our passengers as they were going to the check-in desks. They had people that went through my rubbish bins in my home, rubbish bins of journalists who were also investigating BA at the time, rubbish bins of a nightclub that we owned to see if they could, you know, find some needles or something to prove that, you know, somebody had taken drugs in the nightclub, which is quite likely they would have done. But, and, you know, then they would, you know, try to place the stories with the newspapers and so on. And then at the same time, they were trying to discredit us financially with banks and other things. So it was a systematic attack. British Airways had successfully done that with Freddie Laker, and they'd had to pay out quite a lot of money when he disappeared. You know, it was the way they behaved. Once we won the court case, Lord King had to resign, who ran British Airways. And since then, you know, we have competed fairly. You know, they haven't resorted to these sort of dirty tricks. You know, we think that they have a monopoly at Heathrow of the slots, and that's a battle we'll fight with the government. But I don't have to worry about people going through my rubbish bins anymore.
It's fascinating hearing you recount all this and thinking back as well how Virgin impacted on the travel market, you know, this younger, more fun way of flying. Your whole voice, your presence in that was always one of being both innovative and disruptive, which is quite interesting, isn't it? Were you conscious of that, of wanting to be a troublemaker in this staid airline business?
Yeah, I think there's no point in starting a company unless you're going to create something that, you know, you can be proud of, that your staff can be proud of, that the customers love. And we all love an individual with a sense of humour. You know, if a company can have a sense of humour too, I think that's good. For instance, April Fool's Day is my favourite day of the year. One year in the early days, we built a UFO, as you do, and we flew over London at 4:30 a.m. on April Fool's Day, and went, you know, coming down the motorway, every single car stopped. Everybody was standing outside the car. The whole motorway's come to a standstill. The police were called out, three different police forces. The army were called out. And we landed in a field just outside Gatwick. They surrounded the field, and then they sent a bobby with a truncheon towards the UFO. As the bobby came close to the UFO, our door opened just like an ET. Yeah, we were pumping dry ice out through the door, and we had a midget of about 3 foot tall, 2 foot five, in an ET outfit, and he walked down the steps, and the policeman turned and ran. But anyway, the reason I tell that story is I think that it's doing fun things that make people smile, that I think endear you to what you know to the brand. They're also fun for myself and our friends to do anyway.
Well, what's interesting hearing that story is it's partly of its time, because now, what with security scares, I think you'd got into a lot more trouble. But also, if I may say, the image of kind of reckless, sexy glamour, which was very much cultivated, very much fun in the 1980s, the racy red, the turning women upside down, there's a lot of photographs of you doing that. Some people were uncomfortable about it then, and I think it's fair to say now, even more so. Do you have any discomfort at all about how far you might have taken it?
I don't think anybody was uncomfortable with it then. I mean, Kate Moss, you know, was our first model that we signed to our model agency. And, you know, I turned her upside down on the wings of the plane. You know, she smiled, the press smiled, the newspapers lapped it up. Freddie Laker once said to me, you know, when we were just starting the airline, Richard, British Airways have got hundreds of millions they can throw at you in advertising. You've just got to get on the front pages of the papers if you're going to survive. And we took his advice and we threw ourselves into it. And I completely agree. We wouldn't. It's something that you don't do today. But in those days, they loved it. The press loved it. And it made people smile.
Was there ever a business attempt or a thing that you went into that wasn't fun and you thought, I wish I hadn't tried this?
They weren't necessarily all successful, but they were all a lot of fun. I mean, we took on Coca-Cola, which is a formidable giant, even bigger than British Airways. We had a year and a half of tremendous success. I mean, people lapped it up, literally. We were outselling Coke and Pepsi in the UK and in one or two other countries. We then made the mistake of turning our firepower literally on America. And I arrived in Times Square with a British Sherman tank, crushing, you know, piles of Coca-Cola and Pepsi cans, and cola was squirting everywhere. And, you know, we then turned the tank's turret onto the Coca-Cola sign, and which we'd pyrotech'd the night before. Coke were not amused. And the next day, literally, they got a DC-10 in Atlanta at their head office, filled it with SWAT teams and money. And these SWAT teams and the money arrived. And suddenly Tesco's became very wealthy as they were taking Virgin Cola off the shelves, as did most other retailers in Britain. And you know, within 6 weeks, we'd been kneecapped very successfully. And we did not know at that time what was going on. It was about 3 years later that my new bank manager at Lloyd's took me out for dinner and said that she was the lady at Coke that had overseen this kneecapping. But she was delightful, so she's still my bank manager.
Well, you're laughing about it now, but it's a real David and Goliath moment, a bit like with the airline when you had BA's dirty tricks and you had real financial risk involved in trying to save your airline. Was it ever frightening?
Oh, yes. I mean, there's a very thin dividing line between success and failure if you're an entrepreneur. And I think in those days, there was even an even thinner dividing line because, you know, the word entrepreneur hardly existed. I mean, when I was young, you know, British Airways, British Coal, British Steel, British Gas, everything was run by government badly. And British Trains, British Rail, sorry. Yeah. So there weren't people you could go to borrow money from. You know, when we started the airline, we had this wonderful inaugural flight. I came back to my house to find the bank manager sitting on my doorstep, literally sitting on my doorstep. And he came inside and he said, you've gone 100,000 over your limit in starting the airline, and we're going to foreclose on you on the Monday. And this was the Friday evening. I just said, look, I'm really sorry. You're not welcome in my house. And I gave him a gentle push outside the house and then thought, I've just pushed the person out of my house who's about to take the house on the Monday and everything else we had. And anyway, we then scurried over the weekend, managed to get the overdraft below. This was Coutts & Company was the bank. And we had a 3 million overdraft facility. We then took our profit figures, et cetera, to Lloyd's. And by the end of the week, they'd given us a 30 million overdraft facility, you know, with the exactly the same figures that Coutts had. So, yeah, it can be perilous building companies.
I'm quite interested in some of the things that didn't quite work out, particularly Virgin Beauty, which was your venture into the cosmetics business. And what I remember reading at the time was people saying, you always hired the best from the competition when you were starting out. What did you learn from experiences like that?
I mean, fortunately, we haven't had many failures. We've had Virgin Brides, we've had Virgin Cola, we've had Virgin V, which was the beauty side.
Yes, I just remembered Virgin V. You had a shop on Oxford Street. And I should say, I was a huge fan of the products there.
I think with most companies that fail, you know, we'd not differentiated ourselves dramatically with the competition. So, you know, we're just about to launch a Virgin Voyages or a cruise company. Does the world want a new cruise company? I would never want to go on a cruise. So we decided let's try to create the kind of cruise company that myself and my friends would love to go on. And, you know, so we got a massive big blank piece sheet of paper. We've created, I think, the cruise line that is going to be fun, which everyone would love to go on and would want to come back for more. And we've got four or five new ships coming. Actually, I'm going to go on the 1st in November just to check it out. With the cruise line, it's going to be the best. I mean, absolutely the best. You know, like no buffets. It's going to have 28 of the best restaurants on board. You know, the best music, the best everything. With the few companies that have failed at Virgin, we might have been the best in a sense, but we weren't, you know, like with a cola, you can't be dramatically better than Coke or Pepsi. And, you know, so when they try to put you out of business, it's quite easy for them to do so. With an airline, because we are so much better than British Airways and because people loved and still love to travel on Virgin Atlantic or Virgin Australia or the other airlines we set up around the world, they've survived and thrived.
Can I ask about the space travel? Because you have stayed committed to it with Virgin Galactic, and I know people who bought tickets very early on. Has it been frustrating watching the likes of Elon Musk kind of suddenly come in there and launch his different bids? And where is Virgin Galactic now?
So on the positive side, in response to the Elon Musk comment, Virgin Galactic is the only company in America to have put people into space since 2009. And we put five people into space. So we've had a fantastic year. And Elon and Jeff Bezos have not yet built a craft to put people up. I mean, they will, but they haven't yet. So we're very proud that the team have succeeded at doing that. It's been, I think for all of us, Jeff started, I think, a year or two before us. For all of us, it's been about 14 years of hard work. And rocket science is difficult, and we've found that, as has Jeff and as has Elon. You know, but now we have a wonderfully safe rocket that's been tested and tested and tested that can be switched off at a second's notice. We've got a mothership, which we built. We've got a number of spaceships that we've either built or are building. We've got a beautiful spaceport in New Mexico. And early-ish next year, we'll start taking people up into space. I'll go up and, you know, it'll be the start of quite an exciting new era. And we've also been building something called Virgin Orbit, where we're going to be launching rockets from underneath a Virgin Atlantic 747, helping connect the 4 billion people who haven't got internet access through putting satellites into the sky. And that company will be launching its first rocket into orbit in roughly 12 weeks' time. And so exciting days, I think, for Virgin Galactic and for Virgin Orbit.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV.
One thing here at home in Britain, which I think has been more controversial, is Virgin's involvement in NHS healthcare contracts and to some extent in privatised railways, although less so. And I know that last year there was a campaign complaining that when Virgin Healthcare didn't win one contract, they sued clinical commissioning groups in Surrey. And I just wonder what you'd say to your critics, because that issue around healthcare in particular, it's one that really does arouse people's kind of political divisions, doesn't it?
So starting with Virgin Rail, 21 years ago, anyone who's old enough to remember will know that British Rail was abysmally run, and the government decided to allow a number of private companies to come in and see if they could improve it. And at that time, there were 8 million people on the West Coast mainline. As of this year, we've actually built that number up to 40 million. You know, should we have gone into healthcare? I sometimes wonder. Gordon Brown asked me to come to Downing Street one day. He was the Labour Prime Minister at the time, and he said that he would love to bring some of the sort of Virgin experience to the NHS. You know, would we consider doing it? And we thought we'd give it a go. And I think that the team at Virgin Care have done a tremendous job. Any profits that we make will be reinvested in the NHS, so we'll never take any money out. And we've invested something like £40 million, I think, into the NHS, which is monies they wouldn't have had otherwise. But more importantly, a lot of expertise. You know, having said all that, I understand people's worries about private companies being involved in the NHS and suing
when you don't win a contract.
Even if I think that it's a good thing. As far as suing is concerned, you know, I didn't know the company had done it. Looking into why they did it, I think they had every justification for it. And the fact that the commissioner paid the damage, I think will stack up the fact that we had the justification for doing it. It obviously didn't look good. And would we have done it again? I don't know. But the important thing is that money is not coming to Richard Branson. It's staying within the NHS. And as I've said, if we do make money out of it, 100% will go back into the NHS.
It's clear that you are thinking about your legacy, of how you want you and your brand to be thought of. And I was thinking as well about the elders, which is this board of kind of elder statesmen and women and activists that you kind of came up with the idea for with Peter Gabriel. I think Jimmy Carter is one of them, to kind of intervene in major international issues. Where did that idea come from?
Well, Peter and I both came from slightly different approaches as to how we ended up with the elders. So we had persuaded Saddam Hussein to release some hostages from Iraq in return for some medical supplies. And we flew our 747 into Baghdad airport, met Saddam Hussein at the airport, handed over the medical supplies and took the hostages back to England. I then thought, having, you know, got to know Saddam Hussein in a tiny way and knowing King Hussein of Jordan, who knew him very well, that maybe that we could stop the war that was looking like it was going to be inevitable with America and Britain invading the country. And I just thought, if we could persuade Saddam Hussein to step down and go and live in Libya for the rest of his life, that the war could possibly be averted. So King Hussein of Jordan contacted Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein said that he'd be willing to consider it if we could bring some elderly statesmen over to talk to him and possibly fly out with him. So talked to Nelson Mandela, who agreed to go if I could get Kofi Annan to go with him, who was Secretary General of the United Nations at the time. And Kofi Annan agreed to go as well. We had a plane standing by in Joburg, and then the bombing started. And so the meeting never took place. But what it got me thinking was, if there were a group of elders who were highly respected in the world, that they could perhaps go into conflict regions. And because these leaders in different parts of the world would look up to these elders, that they could maybe knock heads together and bring peace. So Nelson Mandela agreed to be the founding elder. Gresham Machel was the founding mother of the elders. And, you know, Kofi Annan signed up, President Carter, Mary Robinson, Ban Ki-moon is an elder. Anyway, an extraordinary group of people of roughly six women and six men. And, you know, they had an early success. I mean, Kenya was falling into the most ghastly civil war after an election that the opposition thought had been rigged. People were being burnt alive in churches and in their homes and so on. And Kofi Annan, you know, flew down there. Archbishop Tutu, who was one of the elders, came up from South Africa and one or two other people, and they took the leader of the opposition and the leader of the country to a game reserve for 2 or 3 weeks. They knocked heads together, a coalition government got formed, the conflict dropped away. They've obviously had other situations where they haven't succeeded. I mean, they worked very hard on Syria, couldn't get the support of America and others that they needed. But they are working on different situations around the world. Sadly, Kofi Annan, who was the last chair of the elders, is no longer. But we have got Mary Robinson now, who chairs the elders, and she's a formidable force. And they don't just deal with conflict. In the Paris climate talks, we were there with the elders. We were there with another organization that we set up, the B Team, which is a group of very well-respected business leaders. And, you know, we were systematically going around, you know, the Indian Minister of the Environment, the Chinese Minister of the Environment, explaining why they needed to support the Paris Agreement. And at the end of it, you know, it was a tremendous outcome, even if what's going on in America is not helping at the moment.
It's clear that you're thinking a great deal about what's going on in the wider world. And some of the people listening might find it at odds with the image they've had of you as that kind of jolly businessman who kind of does a lot of stunts. You mentioned earlier some quite strong comments about the impact of Brexit, for example, on shifting goods across borders. What are your thoughts about where we are and the Prime Minister's handling of it? And I'm conscious we're speaking at the very start of October. By the time this airs, who knows what state we're in? But you clearly have a view about Brexit.
I think I've made my view fairly clear about Brexit. I think it's the worst thing that's happened to Great Britain since the Second World War. I think it's the worst thing that's happened to Europe since the Second World War. The European Union was set up at the end of the Second World War by people like Churchill and others to make sure that we would never go to war with each other again in Europe. Since then, it's been a bastion of peace, a bastion of democracy. You know, it's extraordinarily sad that kids of people who live in Britain will no longer be able to work in Europe, will no longer be able to live in Europe. It's incredibly sad that businesses and therefore the people who work in those businesses have been so badly damaged since the referendum, and will be damaged even more in the years to come. You know, I could just give you examples of our own businesses. I mean, Virgin Atlantic, that we've spoken about, it has cost tens of millions of pounds since the Brexit referendum by the collapse of the pound from 152 to, what, you know, 122. All our costs are in dollars, fuel, maintenance, lease costs. And that's been a big financial blow to the company. And then on top of that, if we go for a hard Brexit, we send about £100 million worth of goods to around the world, but we get that £100 million from Europe. That will stop. I mean, that'll just go on European airlines and not on British airlines. So, you know, the list is gigantic of all the negatives, and one just wonders why we're ploughing on and on towards the edge of the cliff.
Finally, what do you want your legacy to be?
Your legacy is basically how you brought up your children, you know, how you and your wife have brought up your kids. They're the people that live on after you, and they're the people who, you know, continue, hopefully, the good work of their father or mother. You know, I'd like to think that in various things that we've done and are doing, that we've made a bit of a difference and hopefully improved other people's lives. You know, apart from the elders and the B team, we're working a lot on the oceans, you know, trying to get to 30% of the oceans protected by 2030. We've worked a lot on drug reform and trying to, you know, have governments treat drugs as a health problem, not a criminal problem. Anyway, being an optimist and having got parents who both lived well into their 90s, I'm hoping for the next 25 years to still be working on them. So legacy is something I've not got to think about for the time being.
Sir Richard Branson, thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
You've been listening to How I Found My Voice. I'm Samira Ahmed and the producer is Farah Jassat. We'd love to hear from you. Let us know what you think of this episode by rating it and reviewing us on Apple Podcasts.